You're listening to the OneOfUs.net podcast network. OneOfUs.net and all of the shows on it are 100% subscriber supported. Please consider becoming a subscriber to OneOfUs.net. Keep the site and all of our great shows going and get some terrific bonus content as well.
Now, here's something interesting, too. Speaking of more kind of crime mystery stuff, we got Uncut Gems, the news film of the Safdie brothers.
Oh, this one is one of those ones that it's hard to really sum up because a lot of shit happens, but I'm going to try and do my best.
Well, it's very similar to like the previous one they did, Good Time, where like you can't summarize the plot of Good Time. Just kind of, it's a stream of consciousness almost.
With Good Time, there is like a very base point A to point B. Like, there's a very clear goal where it's Robert Pattinson trying to get his brother out of jail before the weekend.
Okay.
All in one night. With Uncut Gems, it's a lot more free-flowing than that, because we're following this jeweler named Howard Ratner, who works in New York. He's a jeweler. He gets this gem, this uncut gem, from like somewhere in Africa, and it's him essentially trying to deal with debts from all these collectors, because he owes a lot of money to a lot of bad people. He's trying to balance his life with like his mistress, who's like his coworker, and his life with his family, with his wife, played by Idina Menzel. He's also trying to get most of the time he's just scheming to make money. And so early on in the movie, Kevin Garnett, like the basketball player, comes in playing himself, like a different version of himself.
And playing himself?
Yeah, he's playing himself. Like, dude, I should mention, this movie takes place in 2012.
Okay.
Yeah. Trust me, it's very important to the plot. So, for the most part, for the movie, it's him just trying to get the debt collectors off his tail. But at the same time, he's constantly scheming and trying to make more money. Like, he bets on a lot of sports. He's trying to get more money off of Kevin Garnett with this diamond that he has. And just... the whole movie, you're just like, don't do this. And then the plot, like, he'll make a plot, the plot doesn't work, and he's in even bigger shit than he was before. And you're just like, dude, just stop.
This sounds, again, just a lot like Good Time, where Rob Pattinson keeps doing stuff. You're just like, dude, things are just only going to get worse.
Exactly it. I'll say that while it's way more free-flowing than Good Time, it's very stylistically similar to Good Time, where it's just like, this dude keeps making stupid decisions, and you're just there like, no. No, because it's in a very hyper-realized, hyper-stylized, but still very grounded in reality type of world.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, and looking at the cast list here, there's actually quite a few people. Like, I mean, the main guy we're talking about here is Adam Sandler playing Howard, which
is, honestly, the first time in 2 decades I have liked him in anything.
Okay, because this is, like, the first dramatic role he's really done in, I mean, a decade, more or less, feels like.
Since, like, I mean, like... The Meyerowitz stories or whatever the fuck that was called.
Using that one.
That one got a lot of praise, but again, I don't fuck with Noah Baumbach like that. this is the best thing I've seen from him in a long time. He's a piece of shit, but you're still just weirdly rooting for him.
Okay.
What's it called? Lakeith Stanfield, who, again, dude, he's killing it this year. He's playing his, like, middleman, Damani, who's the one who brings in the celebrities, like, Kevin Garnett, and The Weeknd, who plays himself.
Yeah, I saw that. I'm like, wait, The Weeknd?
Yeah. Oh, The Weeknd gets into a fight with Adam Sandler, and it fucking rules. Like, an actual fist fight.
That's amazing.
And even, like, the debt collectors played by Judd Hirsch. I don't remember who the other guy is.
Oh,
but I remember Judd Hirsch. He's intimidating every time he shows up. You're like, he's going to fuck Adam Sandler up.
Is it Eric Bogosian?
Eric Bogosian. That's it. Arno.
Yeah.
They're after him constantly. And like I mentioned, everything, you're just like, you're in the clear. If you just do this one thing, you could be fine and set. And he's like, no, I can make more money if I do this. And you're just, at a certain point, the entire crowd just went, come on.
Well, I mean, that's usually a good sign if the audience is all in like that, but...
I'll say it does run a bit long if there's one of those things where it's another 2-hour and 10-minute movie. Personally, I felt like it ran long, mainly during the scenes where it is about, like, him and his family life, but it all comes together in this third act, which is really about basketball. Like, this is when Kevin Garnett himself comes in, and it bases it surrounding real-life events.
Oh.
And me not knowing the outcome of that real life event, I was just like, what is going to happen?
Okay. Yeah, no, I don't know this either, so I'm very, very curious.
Yes.
So what's cool about this, too, is that A24 is distributing this in America for December 13th, but internationally it's going to be distributed by Netflix, too. For
yes,
everyone else
which is interesting. It. Apparently it's going wide in America on Christmas Day, which is an interesting thing. Oh, I should also mention that this is, like, the most Jewish movie I've seen in a long time, too, because,
yeah,
like,
don't say, an Adam Sandler movie being really Jewish.
No, no, but this one is, like, more than ever.
It can't be more Jewish than Marvis Mrs. Maisel. That's like the most Jewish thing I've ever seen.
Oh, trust me, it does.
Okay, I'm curious. So yeah, it sounds like you overall enjoyed this. I mean, was there any other big like highlights or things to talk about it? Or
no, it's just I'll say that a lot of movie is noise. Like, and I mean that genuinely. Like, it's a lot of movie is like Kevin. It's Adam Sandler arguing with like six different people in a room at the same time. And so it ends up being like an It's Always Sunny soundtrack on steroids, where it's like everyone is talking over each other, especially with the soundtrack by the same dude did the Good Time thing. I think it's like 10 Point Tricks Never. I got that name fucked up, maybe.
Oh, but, yeah. I think his real name's like Daniel LePayton.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah.
10 Tricks Point Never. That's it. And so that score is going alongside all these arguments, and you're just disoriented. And that's the movie. That's what the movie's trying to make you feel. You're just like in this space, and you feel claustrophobic, even though it might not be. But it's just so just gripping and interesting that I was still hooked in all of it.
Well, that's awesome. So yeah, then I guess what would you give for your final rating for the movie?
8.5 NBA championship rings out of 10.
How do you get half a championship ring though?
Listen, cut the gem. That's what you do.
Well, it's not an uncut gem at that point, then. But anyways, next here... Now, this is curious. I hadn't heard anything about this movie either. This is Mosul.
Yes, Mosul, which is produced by the Russo brothers.
Which, that had me really intrigued, because, yeah, looking at the stuff behind this... So this is actually a documentary thriller, correct?
It's not a documentary, but it's a full-on... It's based on true events, where okay. It is... It's an Iraqi film that's about this group of Iraqi soldiers... facing off against a chapter of ISIS that in the movie they call Daesh, which I think it's like that's what they call it in Iraq, at least that chapter. Mm-hmm. But it's very simple until the point. It's like them just trying to do an operation and trying to liberate their city. And it's visceral shit.
Okay.
The best way I put it to people is that it's Iraqi Black Hawk Down.
Okay. My attention.
Like, it's very quick to the point. They jump into it literally from the first second. And it's almost nonstop for the whole movie. And if there's any critical thing I had to say about it is that, like, when you follow this group of soldiers, they don't really give you enough to, like... I mean, like, they give you a little bit of their personality, but essentially it's, like, all just, like, tough dudes or, like, dudes who are, like, just trying to fight these terrorists. And there's one kid who gets, like, sworn into the group who's like a young rookie officer. By the end of the movie he's almost like Rambo. but for the most part, I'll say it's a very, very quick, effective movie that has just crazily intense action scenes.
Yeah,
and I was not expecting it.
Yeah, because this movie's only like an hour 26 minutes, so yeah, that sounds like it's a very brief little war film.
Like I said, it gets to the point. And it sucks that, like, it kind of lost characterization, but at the same time, it's not entirely necessary.
Okay. Yeah, so I don't know when this is going to be distributed wide for us to see down here, you know, for the...
I would like it to, because it is a cool movie, especially considering, like, when you hear about, like, Iraq, and you always see, like Middle Eastern people as, like, the villains. But this, like, at best, it's like Lone Survivor, just from, like, an American version, like... Not an American, an Iraqi version of it.
Okay.
Where it's like, these guys are like all like, we're here to help people.
Yeah, no, I was like seeing like international perspectives on these kind of conflicts. Because we get so many of just America or whatever going out to save the day that it's nice to see how local forces do that kind of stuff.
Especially, yeah, when you like see as like ISIS and it's portrayed as like just generic Middle Eastern type of deal. When it's like, no, they're fighting this shit in their own land too.
Oh yeah, because I mean, that's one of the big things they stress even in the plot details about how... a lot of this comes from them being able to push past their own sectarian differences, because like some of them are Sunni, some of them are Shiites, some of them are Christians, some of them are Kurds. So that, I mean, I'm sure that's not a big factor in the plot, but it is like a thing that's like flavors it a little bit in terms of characterization.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. No, that's cool. I'm really curious to see this, just if it ever actually comes out here in America. Well, to be fair, it says it came out in April, but I'm sure that was like some like festival release.
A festival release screening.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm definitely going to keep an eye on this one then, because again, like you said, developed, produced in some way by the Russos. That's already a big seal of approval.
That's crazy to me. Also, that like the first thing that they produce post Avengers Endgame is like this foreign language thriller.
Well, because they also have that movie 21 Bridges, I think, that's coming out soon too, right?
Yeah, that's the first like relatively big one, but like at the same time, it's like the contrast between like this small, almost weirdly minimalist, like action thriller, to like Avengers.
Yeah, no, and then the ratings so far, like there hasn't been a lot of critical reviews yet, but IMDb has gotten lots of rave reviews. Which, I mean, again, IMDb, take that with a grain of salt. But what would you give this for a rating then?
I give it 7.5 iPods playing Run the Jewels out of 10. Oh, yeah. There's a scene where, like, there's one point where they, like, take a break in this house. And so one of the dudes pulls out, like, an iPod. And he, like, passes one earbud to, like, the new guy. And they're listening to it. And I'm like, that's a fucking Run the Jewels song.
Trying to get that Marvel crossover.
And it's not the one that they play in Booksmart and Good Boys. It's a different one, thankfully.
Okay, that's good. they do have more than a couple songs.
Yes.
Well then, so another movie that we talked about, we kind of hinted at that there was a major sale for a movie that came out of the films you saw. And that's the film Bad Education that you saw with Hugh Jackman.
Yes.
So apparently HBO just scooped this up for a humongous like $20 million deal to stream it on HBO, which pretty much means it's not going to compete for Oscars at all, and from what it sounds like, it's not really strong enough to compete for Oscars anyways.
Yeah, that's where it was probably going to go anyway. That was a much better idea. So for those who don't know about Bad Education, it's based on this real-life event that happened in, like, Long Island back in, like, 2002, about essentially the administrators and, like, the superintendent embezzling money from that are supposed to be towards a school or school funds, and they were giving it for, like, private and personal shit. And so essentially it follows three main characters. Hugh Jackman, who's Frank Tassone, who's like the superintendent, Allison Janney, who's like the main, his secretary and slash the main person who was getting all this fucking cash, and this student Gerald, played by Geraldine, I don't want to mess up her name, Viswanathan, who was just, she was just in Blockers.
Oh yeah, the one from Blockers, right?
Yeah, she was from Blockers. And she's the student who kind of uncovers this whole, like, scheme that happens. And I'll tell you right now that, like, if there was anything that this movie could go for, it probably would have been, like, a Best Actor nom in the Golden Globes, maybe even the Oscars for Hugh Jackman. Because Hugh Jackman owns this movie. Like, he is a smarmy piece of shit. But at the same time, he's so charismatic and likable to these students that you feel, they're like, man, I would like him to be my superintendent. Like, he seems like a dude who's about his community, who loves these people, but then just ended up getting caught up in this thing, and then he kept doing it. And you're like, no, you're just as much a piece of shit as everyone else.
Well, you know, that's the thing. Like, Hugh Jackman always gives, like, 110% in almost any film he's in.
Oh,
like,
even this one, he's trying hard for that Oscar, though.
Yeah. One of these days, he will find a role that's actually in a good movie, too, sadly. But, I mean, because it sounds like there's a huge cast, like you mentioned, with those other actors. And then Ray Romano's in this, Alex Wolff, Rafael Casal from Blindspotting.
Oh, Rafael Casal. When he pulled up, I had no idea he was in it. So that was a massive shock to me. Because he plays Hugh Jackman's like secret lover.
Oh,
and they have their own little relationship. At least like one of the best scenes in the movie, like later on, where they're having like a dance scene, and it's set to Moby because it's 2002. But that scene, that it's intercut with something else that's going on that I don't want to spoil, but it's so good.
Awesome. Well, so what would you say is like the major downfall of the film itself in terms of just any other stuff like filmmaking or storytelling kind of stuff?
It's super inconsistent. Like, not super inconsistent. It's super uneven.
Okay.
Because at first it starts, they're trying to balance between the three, but it's not really balanced well enough. Or it'll be like Allison Janney, something happens to her, and like I think she's like the first one to get uncovered in this whole thing, and then it's like Hugh Jackman just trying to deal with the fallout from like her until he gets caught up in it. And Allison Janney just full on leaves the movie for a good chunk of while. And you're like, oh, right, I forgot that she was here. Or they focus on Geraldine. It's like, oh, right, I forgot you're the one doing this right now. But the it's not ever evenly balanced, or the tone is not balanced well enough to where, like, I don't know if this is a black comedy, or if it's not funny enough, or if it's not dramatic enough. Like, it's not really... The tone doesn't balance well enough, and I think that might be because of the script.
Okay, because it's struggling to find its own identity.
Exactly.
Okay.
It's trying to find, like, a consistent area where that it wants to settle itself into. Like, it's not a boring movie, but it's just... You're like, this is so close to being a really good movie, but it isn't.
Okay. That's a bummer, because the guy who did the movie is the guy who did Thoroughbreds also.
Yeah, Corey, honestly... You could not tell that it was the same dude who did Thoroughbreds.
Oh, really?
Because I know he didn't write it this time. It was Mike Mikowski.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if Corey had written this as well as directed, I think it would have come off more as, like, the script might have been sharper. But as it stands, it's just kind of okay.
Okay, fair enough. So, yeah, I mean, is there anything else really to say about it, or...
Yeah, no, it's a fine movie. Like, it's not completely worthless. There are some good laugh-out-loud moments. And I think the opening and closing shots are really, really cool and really good. But, yeah, you know, it just doesn't do enough. It doesn't have a consistent enough tone to where it can balance itself out. Because, like, no one is bad, but just the movie does them no favors.
No, fair enough. So, what would you say for a rating, then?
I would give it 6.5. School journals out of 10.
Okay. Well, now for something much crazier. We got the movie Honey Boy.
Oh, Shia LaBeouf's therapy sessions, yes.
That's pretty much what it is. Cause,
that's literally what it is.
Yeah, because he wrote the script for this one, right?
He wrote the script. He, you know, he didn't direct. It was his director, a first-time director, Alma Harrell, which I'll say right now, I was shocked that this is a first-time feature, because this is... really impressive.
Yeah, no, the only thing she did previously was, like, this documentary called Bombay Beach and a couple other smaller films. Mm-hmm. So she's been around, but yeah, it feels like for a big film like this, you would, you know, I do like, though, Shia LaBeouf seems to gravitate towards smaller directors like this, because wasn't that same thing with American Honey, where, like, you know, somebody was, like, a small indie director kind of thing?
Yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, essentially, when I say it's Shia LaBeouf therapy session, I am not fucking kidding. Like, it's, they changed the name to, like, it's this actor named Otis Lort, who ends up just kind of having, like, who was a former child star and ends up just getting a bad way, drinking and going to rehab. And as he's talking to, like, his therapist, it flashes back to him as a child and dealing with, like, his abusive ass dad, who's played by Shia. And man, honestly, after watching this, I'm like, I just want to give Shia a hug, because this movie feels so immensely personal. And I mean that, like, way more personal than it actually should be, to the point where, like, I feel like this dialogue is stuff that they actually said.
Oh, yeah. I mean, even just looking at the trailer when it came out, it's like, yeah, this is so clearly his career. Like, what, the opening sequence of the trailer was him doing, obviously, Transformers, or at least the style of that.
Yeah, the Transformers where he does the no. And then even when they have him as a kid performing in the show, it's very clearly, like, the Even Stevens clothes.
Yeah. So, I mean, is that, like, a thing that's constant throughout this, where, like, referencing Shia's career, or is that just a minor thing?
It's a minor thing. Like, it only really goes into, like, two avenues of his life. It goes to, like, yeah, the Transformers thing, him in rehab, which is apparently how he came up with this movie. So it feels like the behind the scenes of the movie that you're currently watching without it being the actual thing.
Okay. But
it's like, yeah, him in rehab, and then him as a child in between him shooting this stuff.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, like we said, Shia LaBeouf playing his dad, and everyone said that he's apparently really, really good in this movie.
He is incredible. Like, he is... Like, he channeled some deep down repressed shit. where he's like almost talking to him as a peer, but also just, like, clearly acknowledging that, like, listen, Shia, I'm gonna keep calling him Shia. Well, young Shia, or the little kid who's playing him, Noah Jupe, young Shia, is paying your bills. Like, don't get anything wrong. Like, even though you're still his dad, he's still paying your bills, because he's giving you money from the money that he's making of his career.
Yeah.
And it's very clear that it bothers him. And, like, there's a couple moments where, like, I could see the fatherly bond, but it's so clear he's a piece of shit.
Yeah.
And this little kid, Noah Jupe, he takes up most of the movie, and he is great.
Yeah, because I remember he's the little kid from A Quiet Place, too.
Is he?
Yeah,
okay, he's the boy. I never saw The Quiet Place, so I didn't know, but no, he he shines in this.
He's one of those up-and-coming child actors, and he's also British, because, of course, everyone is coming from England these days.
Of course.
Yeah.
and then Lucas Hedges, who plays, like, the adult version, he's not in it as much, but he's really good whenever he's there. Who else is in it?
Micah Monroe's in this.
Micah Monroe. Martin Starr is briefly in it as, like, one of the people who Lucas Hedges sees in therapy.
Natasha Lyonne. Yeah.
Clifton Collins Jr. is in it super, super briefly. And FKA Twigs, who's a musical artist, she's really good when she's in it. There's a weird thing with, like, her and young Shia where I'm like, I feel a little concerned. I'm like, I don't know if this is a romance or not, but, like, you guys have a bond together. But I don't know if this leans towards romance, and, like, that child is 12, and I don't like that.
Ooh, yikes. But, yeah.
It's not as bad, I'll say, it's not as bad as, like, mid-90s, because mid-90s, that was way too much.
Okay, fair enough. But, you know, that's the thing with this movie. It feels like, you know, everyone acknowledges, yes, this is clearly Shia LaBeouf exercising his demons from his past. Like, yes. How much of that, like, I mean, well, you know, knowing that that's the big crux of the movie, does it still manage to have its own dramatic weight because of that? Like, it's not just, oh, someone 100%. Complaining.
Okay, just, like, good. The tension between, again, young Shia and his dad, you're just like, at one point, this is going to just boil over and explode in some way, shape, or form, and it does.
Ooh. Nice. No, it's, yeah.
But at the same time, like, it comes around at the end where it feels like, all right, I think he got his closure before he even made this. Like, when he was writing the script, I feel like he actually got his closure then and there. And this is a way to fully expel it. Like, all right, my hands are clean. My relationship with my father is this. We can maybe fix it. I'm not sure. But this is what it is.
Yeah. No, and Shia has been very open about the making of this movie, which I think, one, he did say kind of something like that. Just like, look, we've dealt with this. It's not fully done, but we've at least addressed this in some capacity. But it also feels like, the way he's saying it, again, this is Shia LaBeouf, so take what you will from his words, but it sounds like he's not trying to do this like I can inspire millions of people with my life story. It's like, look, no. This is for me, but...
This is for me, but this is a thing that happens a lot with a lot of kids who have abusive upbringings and shit like that.
Yeah, exactly. So that's what had me so fascinated with this movie. Even when we were talking about it on Breakfast Pub, like, even before the trailer, when they were just casting news for it, I'm just like, this sounds really, really different, and I really want to see how it works, because I believe Aeronauts and Sound of Metal are all the big Amazon films being pushed at the end of the year. So
okay,
yeah,
yeah. Actually, an Amazon rep gave me a free ticket to the premiere. Like, I was just in line, and they're like, "Hey," they gave it to like the 20-30 people in front of us.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, no, it was cool. Like, I was surprised at how much I enjoyed it. I'm surprised at how well made it is. And like I mentioned, Alma Harrell, whatever she does next, I definitely want to see what she does.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, no, it's always nice to see a big discovery like that happen for films. So, mm-hmm. What would you give for a rating then?
8.5 no's out of 10.
No. Well, to transition to another Lucas Hedges movie, let's talk about Waves, because I know you were a huge fan of this movie.
Oh, Waves. I came in blind as fuck for this and came out just emotionally drained in a way that, like, I hadn't been since, like, probably, like, Moonlight or Beale Street. Like, that type of shit.
Wow.
I didn't cry, but it was, like, it was on that level of, like, I just went through so much. But, yeah, Waves is this new movie by Trey Edward Schultz, who just most recently did It Comes at Night. And essentially following this family, where the main... I'll say it's two movies in one.
Okay.
The first half of the movie follows Tyler, played by Kelvin Harrison Jr. His life at the very beginning, he maybe has not a perfect life, but like that type of life where you're like, yo, this is a dude who can do it all, where like he's one of the best players in his school's wrestling team. He's fit, like he works out with his dad, played by Sterling K. Brown. He has like a nice rapport with him and his sister, played by Taylor Russell. He has a beautiful girl, beautiful girlfriend, played by Alexa Demi from Euphoria, who this has been her year. Like, holy shit.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, a lot of things happen. Like, he starts cracking under the pressure because his dad is very demanding. He's like, no, you need to be perfect at this, because like out there, they don't give a shit about you, but you need to be perfect. So is that conflicting things with his girlfriend, and just like life starts to just topple on top of him. And something happens that I will not mention, but I'll say that provides the basis for the second half of the movie when it shifts over to his sister, Taylor Russell, playing Emily, his sister's name. And a tragedy happens, and it's her and the family trying to deal with the aftermath of that. And she just kind of dealing with, like, personal fallout, familial fallout, but also just learns how to kind of move on from certain incidents and such and such. That's when Lucas Hedges also comes in as her love interest.
Okay.
And, yeah, no, this movie took me on a fucking journey. the first half is so just, like, vibrant and intense and crazy. And then the second half is slows it way down and becomes way more personal and emotional. But I'm so invested in both of these stories. And I'll say the way that they play, even with, like, the aspect ratios and the film itself, like, there's a lot of stuff that's in widescreen, and then some of it that's shot like American Honey, where it's, like, almost letterboxed.
Okay.
The music, I love this music that's in this movie. It's essentially, like, my 2014 playlist.
Well, yeah, it's Trent Reznor and Atticus Ross, so.
No, I don't mean the score, I mean the soundtrack.
Oh, okay.
Like, the score is great, but they have a lot of different artists. So, like, Frank Ocean is featured heavily, A$AP Rocky, Tyler, the Creator, Alabama Shakes, Radiohead. Oh. There's an eclectic soundtrack. And I'll say, a lot of it is on the nose. Like, there's one point where they play I Am a God by Kanye when something super intense is happening. And the lyrics are like, these lyrics are satirical, but you're using it kind of literally, and that's kind of ridiculous. But I love the song and the way they used it anyway, so it didn't really bother me all that much.
Okay.
It does run a little bit long.
Well, yeah, it's it's 135 minutes. So
yeah, it's 2 hours, but honestly, this is one of those ones where I didn't feel that length that much, or it never bothered me. I'm like, I don't know what I could cut out here. Because I was just so invested in seeing where this movie goes. Because honestly, by the end of the first half of this movie, I thought that was the end of the movie. And then it's like, no, there's a lot more here. We're just starting.
Okay. Well, you know, what's interesting too is that Trey Edward Schultz, he's not black, a filmmaker, I believe, right?
Yeah, he's not. He's white.
So, I mean, do you feel like that's a big thing that affects how the, you know, the family drama is portrayed, or do you feel like it doesn't really play a factor in it at all, kind of thing?
It does to an extent. Like, it, like, the way the family operates, like, especially with Sterling K. Brown, he has a couple conversations with Tyler and Emily that are like, no, this is a thing. Because they're well-to-do. Like, they have a nice house. Yeah. I'll say that. But at the same time, he's like, no, I had to work hard for this more than you know. And I think it's going to rub some people the wrong way that it is directed by a white dude. But honestly, a lot of it feels so relatable that you can go like, okay, even if I'm not like a black person, I could still go like, I know the overbearing father. I know like the relationship issues and dealing with like being a senior in high school and all this stuff. So like, it still works on that level. It's just such an emotional movie, dude.
Oh, it's good. No, and that's, I say that just because I love watching any kind of good family drama, you know, no matter what the background is, kind of thing. So yeah. When I see this kind of story and I hear what's going on, one, it sounds like the best episode of This Is Us ever with Sterling K. Brown in it. But but it also really makes me excited to see how these kind of these issues are tackled. Because I look at the other people in the cast here, too. We got like Renee Elise Goldsberry as the mom.
Yeah, as the mother. She gets some really good scenes, some really emotional shit.
Yeah, and then Clifton Collins Jr. More Honey Boy connections.
Yes, Clifton Collins Jr., who's playing Alexa Demi's father.
Oh,
and
okay.
He's very briefly in it. I'm talking like two or three scenes. But his whole thing is heartbreaking as fuck.
And then Harmony Korine's
in this? Alexa
Demi,
like I mentioned, she... Pardon?
Oh, and Harmony Korine's in this?
He's basically a cameo.
Okay, yeah.
But yeah, no, Alexa Demi, again, she's a fucking star. Like, especially with like her, like this and Euphoria, she is so charismatic every time she's on screen. Like, there's a huge argument that happens between her and Kelvin Harrison Jr. that is just like, I know these people and I know these types of people and this is uncomfortable and I hope they're both okay.
Aw. Wow.
But at the same time, but then there's times you're just like, no, he's a piece of shit. Or at times you're like, no, she's not right, but mostly him.
Okay. Well, you know, I'm excited about this because I see, you know, like, this is one of those ones, again, just like Sound of Metal. I didn't hear anything about this before it came out. And literally that was the one thing everyone came out going, this is one of the biggest discoveries of the festival. like, just, you know, came out of the blue, totally worth talking about. Now, I'm curious, too, because they're trying to generate Oscar buzz for this, because it sounds like something like, you know, big A24 film, deals with family dramas, deals with, you know, racial dramas and that stuff. Do you feel this has any chances of being pushed for bigger stuff?
I think, honestly, I think it could.
Okay. No, that's great.
I adore, this is literally my second favorite of the festival overall. I could not praise this enough.
That's awesome. So then what would you give it for final rating?
I'll give it 9.5 smartphones out of 10.
Okay, awesome. So then this next film here, just to shake things up a bit, we got Synchronic, a science fiction horror movie.
Yes. Okay, so this one follows Anthony Mackie and Jamie Dornan as these two paramedics in New Orleans. And they're getting a lot of weirder cases of, like, for example, like, one person is, like, a woman who gets a snake bite from, like, venom, but she's in a hotel room in an area with no, from a snake that's not even indigenous to this continent. Huh. Or a dude who's, like, fallen down an elevator shaft, but looks like it looks like he fell from, like, 50, 70 feet.
Okay.
So the main common case between all these weird, like, cases that they've been seeing is this synthetic drug called Synchronic. And so at one point, one of the Anthony Mackie starts taking this drug because for some reason that I won't mention for the story. But when this movie first started off, I thought this was going to be like kind of like almost a generic crime thriller, something like a police procedural like Seven or something. And I'm like, where's this going to get to something different? Because this is just kind of weird. But then once Anthony Mackie starts like trying this drug out, that's when it fully turns into a sci-fi movie, and that's when I think the movie really, really picked up.
Okay, yeah, because I was going to say, like, it sounds interesting just based on the idea of that. So what were you saying was maybe hindering the film before that point, though?
It just, the thing though, it just felt like it was a procedural that you're like, I don't know where this is going.
Okay.
Or this just feels like kind of any kind, like, at first I thought it was just going to be, like, hallucinations. And I'm like, that's kind of lame or whatever. But then when the drug happens, you're like, oh no, it's way more than what you think it is. And that's, yeah, again, that's when the movie opens up. It lightens up a bit, but also just kind of gets a lot more philosophical in weird ways. But yeah, no, I was surprised at how much I ended up enjoying this, because that first act is kind of rough, but once the drug actually takes effect, that's like, oh, okay, now that we're getting weirder, we're getting more interesting. I wish they kind of touched more on the rules of, like, I mean, they do touch a lot on the rules of, like, how this thing works and the effects of it, but I kind of wish that they had more time to actually play with it, because by the time they're like, all right, we're going to try and play with it, the movie just ends. Ah. Or the movie has to wrap up. So I'm like, this is one of those ones where I wish the movie was actually long.
Okay. Well, you know, it's curious, too, because the guys who direct this are Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, who did The Endless previously. Mm-hmm.
Which I never saw.
No, me neither. But then they also did the VHX segment Bone Storm as well. So Bone Storm.
Wait, it seems which like, one was Bone Storm?
I'm trying to remember, too. It sounds like it's one of those.
Was it
like,
in the first one?
Yes. VHS Viral. That's the one.
Oh, okay. I never saw VHS Viral. That was the difference.
Okay.
Well, if it was like one or two, I was like, okay, I wouldn't know. But yeah, no, I didn't.
Yeah, it sounds like they're one of those ones just kind of slowly building up their cred for being like indie sci-fi horror filmmakers kind of thing.
Yeah. Thing is, it doesn't even... Well, actually, no, there are parts that are very horror-ish. But yeah, no, it's like, as a first-time watch, like, it was surprisingly impressed. Like, I was impressed with it. It does make me want to check out The Endless. Yeah, no, it's solid stuff.
All right, cool. Well, then, what would you give it for rating, then?
I'll give it 7 synthetic drugs out of 10.
Okay. Now, and it is only an hour and a half, so it seems like it does fly by very quickly.
I wish they gave it, like, another, like, 15 minutes.
Okay, no, fair enough. The next one here, we're starting to get to our final four, people, so bear with us. The first one is Zombie Child. Now, I'm curious to think about this one, because this one seems to be highly rated, but I don't remember if you said this was one that you weren't as crazy about or not.
I was not a fan of this one.
Okay, well, that answers that question.
Yeah, it is a French drama that's about zombies. Like, it's about zombies, but not, like, the zombies that we know. Like, not, like, the typical American eat brains, that type of stuff. But, like, zombies within Haitian folklore.
Yeah, like traditional zombies.
Which is, like, the original zombies.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's remotely based around this person named Clervis Narcisse, who's like based on a real life person who was rumored to be, or not rumored, but like the first alleged case of zombieism which is like based around like voodoo and shit. And so what they did was they had like a fictional granddaughter come into like this private school at the same time as they're showing like the story of him. And it's honestly, this movie's another case where it's the idea is great, but the way it comes across is so really dull that I just couldn't get into it, because they intercut her dealing with like being the one black child in the, like this prep school, and him being like essentially turned into like a weird kind of zombie slave, because that's essentially what they're trying to hint at. And at first they're so wildly disjointed and they don't bring it up until like a certain point. It's like, okay, that's what they're leading into. But again, yeah, it's just wildly uninteresting. And it's, I don't think it's the fault of any of the actors, because like I think the lead girl, Louise Labeck, who plays Fanny, I think she's really good and impressive, but everything else is kind of just, yeah, it's just dull. And the one time it picks up, it's already too late. I was like, all right, this is the last 10 minutes. You should have done this sooner.
That's a bummer. Because the director behind this is Bertrand Bonello, who did Saint Laurent recently.
Yeah, who was like a very highly praised director.
Yeah, yeah. Or at least very highly praised in those kind of indie spheres of like French cinema kind of stuff.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, this is one of those ones I was like, okay, I'm here to see something like different I wasn't expecting. But yeah, it was a letdown.
Yeah. Well, and also, speaking of the original source material for Clavarius Narcissus, however you say that.
Narcissus.
There was a fictional version of the story that was made back in 1988 in The Serpent and the Rainbow by Wes Craven. So
okay.
Yeah, so I guess it sounds like that might be the better alternative for people doing something more fun with that story.
Exactly.
Okay, so what would you give for the rating? Sorry.
I'd give it 6 zombies out of 10.
Okay.
I'll say, if anything, just look up like the actual history of like zombieism and like Haitian voodoo and that stuff, because that stuff is actually legitimately fascinating.
Awesome. Well, then this next one here is Blood Quantum. Now, that's an awesome title. Doesn't tell you jack about what the movie's actually about.
Oh, so. It's another zombie movie. Like,
there you go.
It's a more traditional zombie movie.
Oh, you know what? No, I do remember now. I saw a news article for this one, because it's like one of those ones where it's saying, oh, this is a fresh take on how to do a zombie invasion story kind of thing. Or
no, so basically what it is that it is a zombie that focuses on like indigenous and First Nations people. Where like, I should mention that it is like directed and written. It's like entirely with First Nations people. But what it is that it's a zombie outbreak, but it focuses specifically on like a First Nations reserve where all the people are immune to the they're immune to the disease because of their indigenous heritage, but they still have to deal with like trying to survive because they can still get bitten, they can still get ripped to shreds and still die, but just like they can't get personally infected. And that's kind of like the setup that they have for the movie. But at the same time, it's like a bit of a family drama between like all these characters. And honestly, I wish they kind of focused more on the actual like social effects of like, why are we the only people who can't deal with this? Like, who can't get infected by this? I wish they kind of took more of that. But as it stands, like regardless, it's an entertaining movie. Like,
okay.
I'll say they do not skimp on the gore. They do some shit that I was like, oh, they're not going to do it. And they do.
Wow.
Like they, like, I'll say like, no one is safe. I'll say that.
Well, that's good when there's actually like suspense like that. You don't know who's going to get it or not. So what's interesting too is that this movie was the second runner-up for the Midnight Madness prize as well. Mm-hmm. So I mean, do you think that? I mean, I don't know anything about these other two movies here that won, The Platform and The Vast of Night.
Platform is one that I'm actually looking forward to seeing at some point, because the Platform is, if you mix Cube with Snowpiercer.
Oh.
Where it's like, it's a prison cell where for food is delivered from the top down. So like the more well-to-do prisoners, like anyone can eat whatever's on the table. So
gee, I wonder what the politics are about in this one.
Oh, it's another class thing. But so yeah, so like whatever's at the top, you might get like a full-on feast, and the people at the bottom might get like literally shit. But what I've heard is that it's absolute insanity, and that it's Netflix picked it up, so it's going to come out soon. So I'm looking forward to that one. But yeah. Back to Blood Quantum. I think it's there because it is like a relatively, not crowd-pleasing, but like as it comes up for like a zombie movie, it does a lot of stuff that you would want a zombie movie to do.
Okay.
I just kind of wish it went more on like the racial, social, colonialist part, because like that's essentially what it is about. like, okay, overall, in a grand scheme of things, but, like, I don't think they touch on it enough.
Well, I mean, that's the hard thing of balancing it out, where it's like, how much of the politics can overwhelm the zombie movie, and how much the zombie movie can suppress the politics stuff. It's always a difficult balance, these kind of
exactly
stories.
Exactly. But yeah, I'll say also, I did like all these characters, like all these actors. I think they're pretty good. Like, they're all relatively solid actors.
Well, that's good. Well, and so I think it's being distributed by Shudder for international release, too. And
I can see. That's a nice place to put it.
Yeah, but then Crave is also doing it in Canada there, so.
Yeah.
Which is good, because Shudder's been delivering some good stuff lately. Like, I don't know if you got a chance to see it just yet, but One Cut of the Dead, which we just reviewed on the site.
I haven't seen it yet, because I wasn't sure if it was out yet. But, yeah, now that I know, I'm going to go see it.
Oh, it's so freaking good, man. That is one I definitely... You should go in cold. Don't look at a trailer. Don't look at the plots.
I haven't. I literally have avoided everything.
Good. Well, I'll do the same for this one. I'll try to be in as cold as possible whenever I get a chance to see it. So, what would you give it for final rating, then?
I'll give it 7 zombie heads out of 10.
Okay, fair enough. Now, for the final two of the biggest movies that came out in the festival, and I can't wait to hear about this one, because this is Dolomite Is My Name.
Oh, this was great. Yeah, it's a biopic about Rudy Ray Moore, and it's about him just moving on from, like, making records, comedy records, to eventually making his own movies, culminating in the release of Dolomite. I'll say this off the top. While they're saying it's about the making of Dolomite, a lot of the scenes that they do is from The Human Tornado, which, honestly, is a much better choice, because Human Tornado is a lot fucking crazier. but it is, this movie is so much fun. Eddie Murphy is back, like, legitimately back. This is the best thing he's done probably since Dreamgirls. And the funniest he's been since the 90s.
Well, because that's the thing, like, it feels like, if I remember correctly, that Eddie Murphy's a humongous fan of Rudy Ray Moore's stuff. Like,
oh, so much. You can tell he's having, this is like his passion project.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And that's great to hear, because I always feel like Eddie Murphy can't be really talented and funny. It's just, I don't know what happened during that decade between Dreamgirls and this, where it just seemed like he just gave up.
Even between like Nutty Professor 1 and Dreamgirls, there was already like some rough shit in there. But yeah, just like, if anything, this is like also another companion piece with like Crazy World, in the sense of like, this movie, like, when you watch the movie, like, you just kind of fall in love with the actual art of filmmaking. Mm-hmm. Because, again, they were doing it off of almost nothing. Like, Rudy Ray Moore was paying a lot of this out of pocket.
Well, because, yeah, like, the Dolomite character was successful even before he made the Dolomite movie, right?
Yeah. 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 He had in a number of, like, comedy records, and that got him in, like, a lot of popularity first off. Like, when he was doing stand-up. And then he just transitioned it into a movie. And just, you could tell that, like, not just the characters, but the actors playing the characters having so much fun being in these roles. So, for example, like, Wesley Snipes as, like, D'Urville Martin, who's, like, the director of the movie, but he's such a thespian that he plays it full on, like, diva mode. And knowing Wesley Snipes for real, like, the shit he's done for real, like, no, that's a perfect fit. But you could tell he's loving it, too. Craig Robinson as, like, Ben Taylor, who's, like, does the music. Keegan-Michael Key was, like, the co-writer. Actually, I'll say the thing with Keegan-Michael Key, that one, this is the funniest he's been, like, in a movie. And two, his whole character is that, like, when Rudy Ray Moore and him are, like, kind of pitching the story back and forth, they're, like, brainstorming, he's, like, Keegan-Michael Key's character is, like, so different. Like, listen, we're trying to tell the tale of the streets. We're trying to tell people, like, how it's life in the real world, like, the urban youth of today, what they're suffering through. And then Eddie Murphy will come and is like, yo, but we need some female ninjas in here. What about the exorcism? And he's just like, Jesus Christ.
Which, we joked about it before the actual record. Well, I mean, just earlier in the recording, too. But, like, man, Rudy Ray Moore loved his women in these kind of movies.
Oh, man, yeah. I'll say the other MVP in this movie outside of Eddie Murphy is Divine Joy Randolph as Lady Reed, who every time she's on screen, she's so magnetic. She's, like, she's hilarious. She's sweet. She, like, actually has maybe the most heart of the movie.
Oh, that's cool. Nice.
A lot of great weird actually, one of the big weirdest, like, not even a cameo, but, like, one of the weirdest supporting roles, and I was shocked he was in this, was Cody Smith McPhee.
Oh, is he in this?
He's in this, because at one point, Rudy Ray Moore hires, like, a bunch of students to, like, actually handle, like, the technical operation, like, the camera work and all that stuff. And so he's, like, the lead student. And so I was shocked to see him in this. There's some cameos by people that I won't mention.
I mean, there's a lot. Yeah, I'll refrain from talking about them. There's a lot of, like, you know, surprise visits from the people in this movie.
Yeah. This movie is just so much fun. It's light. It's like Eddie Murphy. If there's anything, I think he could definitely probably might get a Golden Globe. Maybe an Oscar is a bit of a stretch. I'm not sure, but it's legitimately the best thing he's done in a long time. And even there's a few moments where they bring in the dramatic elements, especially because Rudy Ray Moore did grow up with like an abusive father. Mm-hmm. So there's a scene where he's like rehearsing his lines, but then it turns into like him insulting like a picture of his dad, and it is an emotional scene.
Wow.
But it never ever takes away from like how light it is and how much fun the movie actually is, and just like the perseverance of a dude who won't give up. And it's such an admirable, such a fun movie. I think people will love this.
Oh, I think so too. I mean, people have been comparing it to like Disaster Artist, Ed Wood, and those kind of movies. It feels
more sincere. And like, the thing is, with the Disaster Artist, while they say it's not mean-spirited, it does kind of feel mean-spirited a little bit. This one does not. It feels super reverential.
Well, at the same time, I mean, Tommy was not exactly the nicest person in the world.
Oh, no. So. That's the thing. He wasn't. I'll say that. So, like, I understand that. And, yeah. But at the same time, at least at this one, it's like, this one, it feels more just like, hey, listen, no matter what, don't give up. And, like, he, like, literally, it's a shock that Dolomite got made because the way he was just finagling shit. like, the way he got shit for cheap and just how it was done for cheap and just how people loved it.
Oh, yeah. I mean, people responded to it. It's just the idea of actually having a black filmmaker and black crew and black cast producing movies for black audiences. It was
they make a purpose showing, like, I don't remember what movie they showed, but it was like they were at a movie that was like an entirely white movie and an entirely white crowd. They were like, what the fuck? Like, I don't understand this.
Oh, right. Yeah, I don't remember the movie, but that was the one in the trailer. I remember.
Yes, the one in the trailer, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so it's really cool to see the people behind the movie because the director of this is Craig Brewer, who did Hustle and Flow.
Yeah.
He did that remake of Footloose, which is not awful, but not...
Oh, right. I forgot he did that.
Yeah, right. But he's kind of been adopted into Eddie Murphy's little sphere now because he's also doing Coming to America, the sequel.
So. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, I'm excited to see what they do together on that one, too, because, yeah, this was just a lot of fun.
Yeah, and then the instant I knew I wanted to see this movie is that the writers are Scott Alexander and Larry Karaziski, who wrote
Ed Wood.
Yeah, Deadwood, People vs. O.J., Ed Wood, yeah, and, you know, just so much stuff that it's just like, yeah, of course it's going to be great. Those guys, literally, there's not a film that they've written that I haven't liked, so I can't wait. So, yeah, what would you give this for your final rating?
I would give this... I'd probably give it 9 9 crazy ass rhymes out of 10.
Oh, sorry, Edwood, not Deadwood. Sorry,
I said Edwood.
No, I said Deadwood on accident.
Okay, got that.
So, now for the last one, the big one that everyone's talking about, one way or the other, because again, apparently things can't win festivals this year unless they're laden with controversy. So, this is Joker.
Yep, I saw the Joker movie. It exists. I saw it in all its glory. I don't even need to describe the plot because you already know what the fuck it is. It's the origin story of the Joker. 70s, Arthur Fleck going through a whole lot of shit.
So it's interesting that we mentioned about this before in Breakfast Club that the script or supposed script of this movie got leaked out ahead of time, like a month or two ago. And I had a chance to read some of it from a friend. I will not say
why. I read all of it.
Okay. I actually didn't want to finish reading it because I'm like, I know some of the spoiler details at the end just because people kept talking about it in relation to the script. But I wanted to see, one, what was in there in my experience when I watched the movie, and two, how much changed between the script and the movie. So, go ahead.
I'll tell you right now, most of it is in there.
Okay.
Even one of the things that they do near the end that I was hoping that they wouldn't do, but they did, and it pissed me off.
Okay, because I was curious if that actually made it into the final cut or not.
You'll know when you see it. I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
There's one major thing that they did change that I won't spoil, but it was one of those things that, like, I hated when I read it, and I'm glad that they kind of changed it to in a way that makes sense in the actual movie.
Okay.
Or one that's not as just, like, super incel-y as it is.
That's why I was curious, because you were mentioning about, like, oh, it's an incel manifesto kind of thing.
I was afraid that it could be,
okay,
especially one point, but then they changed that part in the movie.
Okay, that's good, because I think I know which one you're talking about, and I could see where there might be some debatable elements of that, so.
Yes, okay.
Yeah, so let's just say this.
Take this outside, and then even just like outside the whole controversy, just as a movie, is it good?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes, okay. It is. It is a good movie. I will say that. It is a good movie. I don't love it. Okay. I think it's just fine. I'll say that Joaquin Phoenix, all that stuff, all that praise is legitimately, like, that is merited. Like, he is absolutely incredible in this.
Okay.
I don't think I like him more than Heath Ledger, but he is very, very good in his own right.
So what is it about his performance that makes it so good, though? Like, what does he do specifically that makes you, like, people say all the stuff about
him? It's just, like, it's the physicality of it. Because one is just, like, whenever you see him without a shirt, he is gangly. He is just, like, there's times where it's just, like, quiet rage, where it's just, it's so clear that he's seething, or he's hurt, or he's broken, and that something is up and just bubbling.
Yeah, no, because I remember seeing in the trailer, there's that shot from showing it from the back when he's trying to open up a shoe, and you can see all that tension and, like frustration manifested just in the physicality of his look there.
There's so many other shots where it's just, like, him, like, swinging a gun in his house, where it's, like, you just see nothing but bones, and you're just like, oh... And like, I'll say that the it nails the 70s aesthetic. Like, it does look really good, down to like the old school Warner Brothers logo. It is violent, it is dark, it is disturbing.
Okay, that's what I've heard, that people said it's like shockingly violent at some points too.
Oh, one of the deaths is shockingly violent. It is like, yo. Like, you didn't have to fuck the dude up like that.
Well, so,
like, I get it, but goddamn.
So that's the thing that people are saying, like, a lot of the country stems from just how overall grungy and nihilistic the film is.
It is. It's a movie that hates everyone. If there's anything this movie hates, it's the mentally ill. Because fuck. I could not tell you enough how much this movie hates the fucking mentally ill. It is.
Okay, like, so what do you mean by that in terms of hate the mentally ill? Because that's.
As in. It's, like, it vilifies mental illness a lot.
Okay, well, because that's the thing, like, people have been trying to say, like, oh, well, it's actually explicitly about why the mentally ill are being ignored and neglected and what could happen if they're run amok. But I guess that is the thing we can interpret that as, it makes the mentally ill look like violent criminals kind of thing.
Yes, that is basically the case.
Okay, yikes. And I'm sure that stems a lot from just a lot of stuff happening in recent history with, like, the school shootings and the mass shootings and that stuff going on. Yeah. So.
But at the same time, like, that shit isn't an excuse.
No.
Like, I mean, like, concerning real life, but, like, I don't think this movie is, like, as dangerous as they make it seem.
No.
But at the same time, I'm like, the wrong people are going to take the wrong messages from this. That's inevitable. But I'll say that there's one thing I wasn't crazy on also was, like, there's something that happens near the end of the movie. Not before the end, but, like, the big climax. Joker has his whole thing. And actually, even just with Joker, I'll say that they have a whole little subplot involving, like, rich and growing anti-rich sentiment, and that's very much a parallel to, like, right now.
Mm-hmm.
And there's times where the movie isn't sure if they want to make Joker the hero or the villain or the figurehead of this thing, and I'm like, that's the wrong way to go about this.
I mean, and that seems to again draw upon some other real world situations where it's like people become involved in causes that they themselves may not even have wanted to start, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But that is the thing where, you know, again, they're trying to give this weird, I guess, nuanced interpretation where it's like, you're not supposed to like Joaquin Phoenix, but you understand Joaquin Phoenix, why he becomes a villain, but
At the same time, the whole thing in the back of your mind, you're like, you know where he's going, so I'm not wanting to sympathize with
him. Yeah, exactly. So that is always a delicate thing. Like, I guess the movie shouldn't have to provide answers, but I can see where that might be an issue with some people. So
yeah, it's one of those things that, like, yeah, I know, yeah, it's not the movie's job at the same time. It's weirdly, like, low-key is at the same time.
Sure.
But not as much as people claim it to be.
Well, sure, because, I mean, just thinking about it, too, I actually just watched King of Comedy the other night to prep for this film, and that one, Robert De Niro in that one, he's very clearly the villain. Like, you understand him, you understand why he's this crazy nutbag, but he is definitely the bad guy in the story.
That's
in that case.
No, there's a lot of times in Joker where they try to make you sympathize, and I'm just not buying it.
Okay, fair enough.
But I'll say the supporting cast is not bad. Robert De Niro's good when he's there. Zazie Beetz is barely in it, but she's good when she's there. She's in it for maybe like 5 minutes. who else was there?
Well, it sounds like from what most reviews I've heard that it's mostly just Joaquin Phoenix and everyone else just kind of comes in and out.
It really is just his movie. Okay. And just everyone else just kind of shows up on occasion.
Okay, fair enough. Because, actually, apparently Leo DiCaprio was almost considered for the role, which I don't think could have been pulled off at all, honestly.
I think it would have been way more over the top if that was the case.
Yeah, no, exactly. There's a lot of people here. Some people I don't know if you want to fully spoil based on who they're playing in terms of the roles and stuff. But
I mean, you can. I mean, one of them is, like the Waynes are obviously in it. They mentioned that.
Oh, yeah. It's Brett Cullen, who's playing Thomas Wayne in this one.
Yeah, he's barely in it, but he's there.
Okay, and I heard from most people that they make the Waynes, maybe this is, again, filtered from perspective of Joker, but they're definitely not presented as good people.
Thomas Wayne is not portrayed as a good dude at all.
Okay.
It's mostly just him.
It almost sounds like the Telltale Batman, where he's presented as, like, somewhat of a villain in that story.
Yeah, like as a piece of shit, because there's a whole subplot that I won't mention again. Because I know people are trying to go in as spoiler-free as possible.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, there's a whole thing involving him and the Joker. They're like, okay, and all right. And then Thomas Wayne is full-on like an asshole.
Okay. Yeah, so then I've heard a lot of stuff also about the technical aspects. Because one, just looking at the trailer, this looks like it's shot beautifully all the way
through. It is. It's a good-looking movie. Like, I mean, good in the sense that like it's very dingy, it's grungy, it's ugly. That's the aesthetic that they're going for. It's good.
Yeah.
It's good.
No, it's interesting because the guy who shot it is Lawrence Scherer, who just recently did the last Godzilla movie as well.
Oh, okay. I know. I can see that.
Yeah, but then he also directed that terrible movie Father Figures. You remember that with Ed Helms?
Oh.
That failed so hard that he's just like, fine, I'll come back for Joker.
Yeah.
And then also the music is done by, oh boy, Hildur Guðnadóttir. Oh my gosh. But the guy who did the music for Chernobyl as well. So,
okay, that's cool.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, is there anything else really to say about this? Like, I mean, I know you're not as much in the like 10 out of 10 or anything like that.
Crowd, absolutely. But I'm far from a 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
But I'm also not like, this is garbage.
Okay, so.
I fall in the middle leaning towards positive. Like, like I said at the beginning, it's a good movie. Anyone who's wanting to see just like a fucked up, dark ass Joker story will get that in spades.
Okay.
It's just, there's problems in the script that are fundamental problems that I absolutely cannot ignore. And those, to me, like, did weigh the movie down. And even just, like, the inconsistency between not trying not to vilify the Joker and not to, like, make him an anti-hero, I don't like that.
Fair enough.
But overall, yeah, no, it's a decent movie.
Yeah, so then also, I guess, just one last thing. Like, when I say I saw King of Comedy, because everyone says this is clearly Taxi Driver and King of Comedy, but with Joker on it. Like, is that super apparent in the story as well?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Even having not seen those movies, it clearly is.
Okay, fair enough. But
I don't know. I've seen Taxi Driver. What the fuck am I saying?
Yeah, I mean, obviously.
I just haven't seen King of Comedy.
Yeah, even casting Robert De Niro as the comedian and that such, it's like, oh yeah, this is very clearly a reference to his character in King of Comedy kind of thing.
Yeah.
But fair enough. So, yeah, I'm curious now, do you think this has any chances for Oscar consideration other than Joaquin Phoenix?
Other than Joaquin Phoenix? Honestly, the way things are going, this might just end up being a fucking Best Picture nomination.
Wow. Could you believe that?
I don't, like, would I be happy about it? Not, like, would I be jazzed about it? Not exactly. But I'd go, like, I get it.
Okay, fair enough. So, all right, well, in the end, what do you think is its final rating?
7 fucked up smiles out of 10.
Well, and also I'm curious too, like, considering Todd Phillips' other work, like, when you see, like, you know, him doing comedies like The Hangover and that stuff, how does this rank in his catalog?
Here's the thing. The Hangover movies are mad mean-spirited anyway.
Yeah.
So, like, this honestly doesn't feel like that big of a step. If anything, it's probably slightly, it's better written than those movies. And it's about as appropriately dark as, like, Hangover 3. But yeah, I would never call Todd Phillips a great director, but this is still the most accomplished thing he's done in a minute.
Fair enough. All right. Well, that's everything. We had a lot of say about
20 movies.
Yeah. No, so, I mean, I guess, so when you say, like, what do you think with your top 3 movies from this festival?
Top 3, it would be Parasite, Waves, and probably Knives Out is number 3.
Okay, cool. And then, I guess, just gotta ask, what would you think is the worst of the movies
you saw? The Wild Goose Lake.
Okay. I didn't even think about that one.
Yep.
All right. Well, then, anything else to discuss about that, or...
No, it was just, it was a solid festival. It felt weird to me. I don't know why, what the vibe was. Maybe because I was here longer, so the fatigue was there earlier and longer. But just, this year felt weird to me.
Fair
enough. Like, not in a bad way, just in a, man, I feel bad for journalists who have to cover, like, most of this festival.
Yeah, I'm sure they usually have, like, teams and that stuff in that case. Like, again, I will try to get out there next year. I really,
I know a buddy of mine who was like, he was writing a bunch of reviews and he had a quick ass turnaround time to the point where like we would have like conversations and he was just literally just typing for like almost 30 minutes straight and he was like, I'm already done. I was like, what the fuck?
Oh, that's great.
And I'm not like, even though I still have to write my couple of written reviews still, so I still haven't even done that yet. So yeah, I'm writing a couple of written ones.
No, fair enough. Well, thank you so much for being a part of this, Shaq. I always love hearing your big TIFF coverages and that stuff. It gives me good insight to like what to look forward to for the rest of the year, really.
No problem, dude. It's always fun doing them.
Yeah. So then, why don't you just pimp out the rest of your stuff here? Tell people where they can find you on the internet.
Yeah, you can find me on Shaq Excellence. That's S-H-A-K Excellence on all the social media. So Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You already know. You can also find me over at my other podcast, Sequels. That's Sequels with an extra E at the beginning. Where you can find that on pretty much all other social media, so Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and our site, sequels.com. We just put out our recent episode about Stomp the Yard Homecoming, which is a big old pile of shit, but the episode itself is hilarious. And we have our episode coming up soon that I won't say, but it's coming out probably sometime next week.
Yeah, no, you told me what it was, and I'm super excited to hear how people react to that episode.
It's a really funny episode.
I can't wait. Awesome. Well, thank you very much, Zach. And hey, everybody, tune in next time for whenever we talk about more Infestation stuff. Like, I'm sure we'll get a lot more Infestation recordings with Chris, because Fantastic Fest is right around the corner. So,
there might be some overlap in some of the things that they see. They get some second opinions and shit.
Yeah, because I know Knives Out for sure is going to show at Fantastic Fest.
Yes. So. I hope one of them goes see fucking Charlie Kahn too. That's the one I want to hear them talk about.
Well, Chris, if you're listening, that's one to put on your list. So, all right. Thank you for listening, folks, and we'll talk to you later. See ya.
Later, y'all.